Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
In May of 1972, a 20-year-old Lisa Greensfelder arrived at a small Norwegian town for a summer farmhand job on a farm that operated in the old way, horses and wagons instead of tractors, for example. Today, Lisa Greensfelder is a freelance writer who focuses on medicine, biology, and agriculture. She has worked as a farm advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension and as a science writer for UC San Francisco and UC Berkeley. She initiated an agricultural development project in the Guatemalan highlands. Her first book was published in Norway in 1975 and was a Norwegian bestseller. Today I'm going to ask her about Accidental Shepherd, how a California girl rescued an ancient mountain farm in Norway. Lisa Greensfelder, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's great to be here.
I was appreciative as a reader, the things that you did for those of us who are reading your book. For example, right in the front, you give us a map because most of us aren't very familiar with Norway's geography. So thank you for that map.
We can thank University of Minnesota Press for putting this book together and suggesting the map and all the other things that are in it.
Yeah, because the labels of these places are in Norwegian. And speaking of that, you also give us a list of names that come up in your book, like a list of characters that are in Norwegian. And there are a couple of American names, but thank you for that list of names because that's helpful to be able to refer back and forth to the characters.
Wonderful.
And you also include a glossary of Norwegian. That's helpful, too. If you remember, what do you call that dress in Norwegian? And you flip back to the glossary and find out. Now, I mentioned that you have a list of your Norwegian friends and neighbors. And, Lisa, there are a couple more characters in your book that I was especially fond of, and they're not human characters. Who are some? Who are a couple of other characters in your book?
Well, the ones that have formal names were a Norwegian herding dog, a buhund, named Bella, and a Norwegian fjord horse named a workhorse, a draft horse, named Begonia. There were a few sheep that I gave names to, but those were not their formal names.
Well, as an animal lover, I was particularly fond of these characters in your book. And thank you for the photographs. You have beautiful color photographs. We get to see what Begonia looks like. We get to see Bella standing on top of Begonia. Here's this little dog, and always looking right at the camera. What an adorable dog Bella was.
She really was.
So I'm sure people are wondering, what, Norway? This young girl from Mill Valley goes to Norway? So I'm going to ask you to read your prologue, Lisa.
Okay. September 22nd, 1972. Bella trotted ahead as Øystein and I made our way to an outcrop high on the rim of Smørdalen, Butter Valley, a treacherous ravine named for the utter engorging blanket of grasses and ferns that line its walls. Clouds had disappeared overnight, and the air was crystal clear in this chilly sunlight, making it easier to distinguish distant clusters of sheep from flecks of snow or patches of rock. For 3 months, the flock had been running free across these mountain slopes, grazing on nutritious grasses and forbs that grow above timberline. Now, we needed to herd them back home before autumn snowfalls barred their return. From our vantage point, we quickly spotted 8 animals in 3 widely scattered groups, and then something else, a trio of whitish smudges on the steep and rocky south face of Hostaben, a stubby peak sandwiched between its 2 higher neighbors, Skrott and Manfjell. Are those sheep, do you think? I asked. Øystein pulled an old pair of binoculars from his pack and studied the cliffs. Yeah, a ewe and 2 lambs. He steadied his back against a boulder to get a better read on the trio. And it looks like they're Skorfoster. If I'm right, it's going to be quite a job getting them out of there. He stowed the binoculars and we began climbing. Before long, our feet were leaving tracks in pockets of snow that had fallen overnight, keen reminders of why it was crucial to bring the sheep home without delay. Skorfosta. Not so long ago, I would have had a good laugh on learning that people of a mountainous country, 5,000 miles from my home, had invented a word for stuck on a mountain ledge. If I'd been told that I would soon be scrabbling up a boulder-strewn peak in that very country to rescue animals in just such a predicament, I'd have shaken my head in disbelief, for I knew almost nothing about Norway, and I'd never touched a sheep in my life. Yet here I was, a town girl from sunny California, in the company of a Norwegian herding dog and a 50-year-old man whose name translates to Island Rock, setting out on a precarious mission after September snowfall. And what for? Because I was the sole guardian of these three sheep, along with nearly 100 others that were still ranging over these wild tracts. During the long winter ahead, the well-being of this flock would rest entirely in my hands. What I couldn't yet know was that this bond would be mutual. The sheep's lives would depend on me, while I would rely on them for solace and comfort during those dark months when I would find myself skorfast in ways I could not have imagined when I'd first set foot in Norway just 4 months earlier.
This is my guest, and her name is Lisa Greensfelter. She has written a book, Accidental Shepherd. Accidental Shepherd. The cover of her book shows this young woman feeding sheep. And we wonder, what, accidental? It sounds like she's there on purpose. So let's go back. So that you were just reading us was from September 22nd, 1972. Let's back up to May 18, 1972. Would you read that a little bit from that, Lisa?
Okay, this is chapter one, titled The Best Laid Plans. And as you said, it takes place on Thursday, May 18th, 1972. No one was waiting for me, no Johannes, no horse, no wagon. While the driver retrieved my backpack from the undercarriage of his bus, I scanned the faces of people standing nearby. Some were waiting to board. Others were greeting passengers who had just arrived. No one glanced my way, not even the gray-haired man in rubber boots, the only person in this small crowd who was dressed in the baggy clothes and suspenders I imagined a sheep farmer might wear. "Are you Lisa?" A voice behind me boomed in Norwegian. I turned, and there was the man in rubber boots staring down at me. "Johannes?" I asked, peering at him more closely now. He was a big man with bleary eyes, a large belly, and gray stubble shrouding his cheeks. None of this fit my image of the farmer who had hired me to spend the summer working for him. He started talking in a loud voice, running the words of this foreign language together, pausing only long enough to take in a heavy breath. I understood nothing. "Are you Johannes?" I asked again, using the formal term for you in Danish, a language I'd learned as an exchange student in Denmark 2 years before. He may have supplied the answer, but I couldn't pick it out from his volley of words, so I tried something else. "Did you come with the horse?" In our only phone conversation, I thought I'd understood Johannes to say that he would meet me at this bus stop with a horse and wagon. A poor connection rendered his bad English even worse. But I wanted to believe that he might actually have a horse, and I was charmed to think that my arrival could be special enough that he would put aside a truck or car in favor of a more stately mode of transportation. "Could you please speak more slowly?" I said, breaking into the cascade of words. "I'm sorry, I can't understand." During the few hours I'd spent in Oslo, I discovered that Danish was close enough to Norwegian that people could understand me as long as I vocalized all the consonants and vowels that Danes normally swallow. But my strategy wasn't working here. This voluble stranger didn't even acknowledge that I'd opened my mouth. Suddenly, two words popped out of his slurry. "Johannes," I heard him say, "and Voss." So that was it. I'd switched trains in the town of Voss 3 hours earlier, Johannes must have driven there to spare me the last legs of my journey, then somehow missed me at the station. "Is Johannes in Vos?" I asked. "Did he go there to pick me up?" "Yes, he's in Vos, but..." The rest of his answer, like everything else, sailed over my head.
This is my guest, Lisa Greensfelder, and she's reading from her book, Accidental Shepherd, How a California Girl Rescued an Ancient Mountain Farm in Norway. Lisa, it doesn't sound like you're going to be rescuing a farm from what you just read for us. So you've learned that this guy that owns the farm where you think you're going to be is not even in the town where you expected him to be, but you don't catch what this guy who's meeting you is telling you. So what did you learn about this guy you expected, Johannes? What did you expect, what did you not expect to hear about him?
Well, I expected him to meet me, and it would take another hour or so before what I did not expect. Actually, it would take me a couple of hours to learn that what I did not expect is that he had had a stroke just a couple of days earlier, and he was in a hospital in the town of Vos. He had not gone there to meet me up.
So you think, now what do I do? Here I am. The guy that owns the farm is in the hospital. And so what do you think you might do?
Well, this heavyset man in rubber boots, he turned tail and left after another couple. A couple came running toward us and had a big argument with him. And then he just got angry and left. I was clueless. I was just standing there, 7 in the morning. And they beckoned to me to follow them. They lived a block away. I walked to them with their house. They fed me breakfast. They were willing to listen to me and slow down their speech, and they understood what I was saying. And eventually, it took a long time. They had probably said it 3 or 4 times. They told me that Johannes had had this stroke and that, it was really too bad. I wouldn't be able to go to his farm because he lived alone. And, it wasn't a place for a girl like me. So I was devastated at that moment. I had put so much of my energy into coming to this farm in Norway and starting to learn about agriculture. So from there, well, quite a story.
This nice lady who had a gentle tone when she asked you a question, she says, "Lisa, dear, would you like to visit Johannes' farm?" So why don't you read a couple of paragraphs, the answer to I would think you would want to visit this farm, even though the owner was in the hospital. So would you read a few paragraphs from about that 3-mile drive?
Yes. Our 3-mile drive followed a well-maintained dirt road that wound uphill through forests of birch and spruce before crossing an expanse of hilly fields surrounding a small cluster of farmsteads. After that, it narrowed to a single lane studded with potholes and rocks. Slowing to a crawl, Mr. Evanger navigated around a couple of bends to the crest of a small hill. "There they are," he announced, pulling to a stop in front of a closed gate. "The 3 farms of Hovland. That's Johannes's, the farthest in." Strung out ahead of us lay 3 clusters of old buildings, some painted, others weathered and gray, all of them built atop rock foundations and roofed with stone shingles and slabs of rock. Hovland, Mr. Evanger had called this place. It took me a moment to understand that he was not just saying Johannes's last name, but that Hovland must be the name of these 3 farms as well. The word suddenly took on new meaning. It sounded old and strange, but seemed to fit the panorama ahead of us, where scores of sheep and lambs ranged over green hills surrounding each farmstead. A massive mountain with 2 rounded peaks rose into the clouds behind the place that Mr. Evanger had named as Johannes's. Situated at the very end of our long, winding path from Oystese, his farm looked to be the last outpost at the edge of a mountain wilderness.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll return to our conversation about her book, Accidental Shepherd. That guest is Lisa Greensfelder. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Lisa Greenselder, whose book is Accidental Shepherd, How She Spent Time in Norway on a Farm. So at this point in her story, author Lisa Greenselder is learning about this place that, as a reader, we have to look back at the map and said, what was the name of that place? And what, it's three farms that have the name Hovland? So we look back and find out, So this is where she was expected to be. But what did you decide, Lisa?
Well, I'd already been told that I couldn't go there, but I was looking at it with awe and longing and was very sad that I was not going to be able to go there. That changed the next morning. This kind couple put me up overnight, and in the morning, they told me that Mr. Evang had visited Johannes in the hospital the night before, as I lay sleeping for 16 hours after my long trip.
So you're recovering from your flight, yeah?
Well, it wasn't quite a flight, but it was
more
trains,
than that.
Buses,
yeah.
And ferries.
Yeah.
So Johannes wanted to see me. And that evening, this is my second evening there, Mr. Evanger drove me up to the hospital. It's a two-hour drive along the extraordinarily gorgeous Hardanger Fjord, rimmed by mountains covered in snow, and very early spring there, although it was the middle of May, leaves just appearing on all the trees. And there in the hospital, Johannes pleaded with me to take care of his farm while he recovered from his stroke. He'd be home in a month or two, and there was no work to do. Just be there and walk around and, you know, look at the animals every day. And I considered this. I thought, I don't think I can do this. But then I thought, well, why not? There's no work, and it's the most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life. So I said yes. And the next day, I was driven up to the farm by one of Johannes's sisters and plopped down in big old farmhouse at the end of the road, 3 mile road, with the mountains behind me and a whole lot of animals to take care of. And it was really not true what Johannes had said, that there was no work to do.
Yeah, so he seemed like a nice
really
enough guy.
True.
Yeah, yeah.
He did seem like a nice enough guy, but, that was maybe a little suspicious because he was not telling the truth.
Well, the language is a problem when you start out, and I'm sure people are wondering, well, how in the world? Because you'd spent time in Denmark, so you knew Danish, but here you are faced with this language in Norway. So I'm going to ask you to read, when you're listening to them speaking Norwegian, and this is on page 40, Lisa, I'm going to ask you to read from, this is chapter 6 now, we're skipping over to chapter 6, and you realize that you were listening to a woman who you soon realized you could understand almost everything she said. So would you read those?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'd been there for several days, a week, when I met this neighbor, a woman, and I hadn't been able to understand anybody, although I was able to make everybody understand me within a week. So her name was Inger. As I listened to Inger's stories, I soon realized that I could understand almost everything she said without having to invoke my usual appeals of, could you please speak more slowly, or pardon me, what did you say? When I asked her why this was, she explained that she hailed from Bergen, a place where people spoke with flatter tones and a grammar far more akin to Danish than Norway's other dialects. Before leaving California, I'd learned that Norway had two official languages. I'd been hoping that Øystese was the town that I arrived in, was a place where Bokmål, the dominant language, was spoken. Bokmål was so similar to Danish in its written form that I'd had little trouble reading an Ibsen play in Norwegian for a school assignment in Denmark. My understanding was that Norway's other tongue, Nynorsk, spoken by less than a third of the population, was a few steps further removed from Danish. My hopes of an easy language transition were dashed almost straight away when Mrs. Evanger informed me that Øystese and almost all of Western Norway were deeply rooted in Nynorsk. But no one actually spoke either of these two official languages, she said. Instead, almost every town, valley, and fjord in the country had its own dialect. With a hint of pride, she added that the local band of Nynorsk, dubbed Kvammamål, was considered one of the most difficult dialects for outsiders to make sense of. The reason that I'd been able to carry on a conversation with her and Mr. Evanger, she explained, was because they often substituted bokmål equivalents of Nynorsk words they knew I wouldn't understand.
This is my guest, Lisa Greensfelder, reading from Accidental Shepherd, How a California Girl Rescued an Ancient Mountain Farm in Norway. So you're an accidental shepherd, and you say that you don't know anything about sheep, and the Norwegians that you encounter are very nice people, but they laugh at you, Lisa, for what you don't know. Does any particular example come to mind of something that, I had no idea? What did you not know about, for example, taking care of these animals?
I did not know how to milk a cow.
Yeah, well, I would expect that. A girl from Mill Valley knowing how to milk a cow, I would kind of expect that. So, but the owner of this farm says, okay, Lisa, you're in charge. You have my authority to do whatever you think you need doing. I said, okay, I'll do that. So one of the things you had to learn was how to milk a cow. And who was your teacher?
Well, I had to learn that very quickly because I probably knew that cows needed to be milked every day. I maybe knew that they needed to be milked twice a day. But I got there and I instantly learned, yes, twice a day. And like an hour or two after I got there, it was time to milk the cow. And a woman came, a 60-year-old woman, kind of with a bad hip, came walking up to the farm. I learned later that she was the woman who lived on the first farm of Hovland's three farms. It was about a half mile, not quite a half a mile walk for her. And she came in and introduced herself and said she was going to teach me how to milk the cow. And there ensued some tears, spilled milk, injured knee, my knee, after my first attempt to milk. And she was kind of appalled and worried about the animal and made a deal with me that she would come and start milking the cow morning and evening, that I would start milking the cow morning and evening from what she'd already taught me. And she would come and take over for me.
I've never milked a cow or even watched somebody do it, but I wouldn't think I would injure my knee milking a cow. How did you do that?
I didn't do that. The cow did that. The cow she did not appreciate my efforts. Uh-huh. And I was just sitting there thinking that she was enjoying it. And out of the blue, this rear hoof lurches out and kicks my knee, and I hobbled around for at least a day on that injured knee.
You have a lot to learn.
Yes.
And Bella was the sweet dog that was your friend right away, and also Begonia, the horse. You and she, both the horse and the dog, became good friends right from the beginning. And unlike this cow that says, hey, wait a minute, I don't like this person doing this, milking me. So you learn how to milk a cow. And what else did you learn that kind of surprised these neighbors of yours? What? This girl doesn't know that?
Well, through the year, I had to learn probably 100 new things. Going back to the horse, Begonia, what I learned my first day at the farm is that Johannes was going to meet me with the horse because he didn't have any motorized vehicles on the farm and no mechanical equipment. Everything was run as the farm had pretty much been run, and the neighbor farms had pretty much been run for the last 100 years. And so I had to learn how to drive a horse. I had had a horse growing up in Mill Valley, California, for several years. So I knew how to ride a horse. And actually, I knew how to shovel horse manure. But I did not know how to drive a horse to do all of the hauling that I needed to be done on the farm. So she was my horsepower, and I had to learn how to drive her. And that was interesting. Should I tell you what the commands are for stop and go?
Yes.
Okay, I'll try. Okay. Stop is... And if you don't do that, the horse doesn't stop. You can't say whoa. You can't pull back on the reins. You got to do that noise. And go is... oh my gosh. I'm sorry, Nancy. I'm completely forgetting go. I might remember it in the course of our conversation.
But there's a sound. They're not really words. They're sounds that you make
that
Begonia
sounds.
Would understand. She wouldn't understand you speaking English, for example. You wouldn't expect that.
Yes.
Well, something else. Those of us who are animal lovers, I just loved your relationship with these sweet animals. But there was one time when I was just holding my breath because you were told you had to use a gun. And we're reading this and thinking, oh, Lisa, please don't do what they're telling you to do, because your neighbors were telling you, here, use this gun. And why were they wanting you to shoot this other animal? What animal was it they wanted you to shoot?
It was a fox, a European red fox. And one morning, Solvay, this neighbor who had come over and was helping me tremendously for the first couple of weeks until I really got my footing on the farm, when she came to help me milk that morning, she said, you know, there's a ewe on your field that has, I think she's lost her lamb. I heard her bleeding all night long. And I had heard that too. And I had no idea that it meant anything. You know, it was the language of a sheep. And that's the first time I realized that sheep have a language. And this mournful bleeding all night long meant that she'd lost a lamb. And so after we milked, we walked up the field and found actually half of a lamb, almost like it had been cut in two, and there was no sign of the other half. And she said, well, this must be a fox that has done this. There were no other predators. All of them had been extirpated in that region. And when Johannes heard it, he came from a long line of fox hunters, and he just told me to kill the fox. I had to kill a fox. Had to take his gun. He had three rifles, different kinds, World War II carabiner and a shotgun, and something pretty close to my mom's .22 that I had used just a couple times. So I took it. And
you're thinking only a human could kill a lamb, cut it in two, and make off with its head and front legs.
Yeah.
And so you were thinking, oh, a human did this. But they're telling you, nope, it was the work of a fox.
Right. And I had to believe them. You know, that's what everybody said. And the boys next door would pull my leg a lot, and I would believe them until I learned not to. But nobody else was kind of fooling around when they were trying to instruct me. So I figured it was a fox, but this went totally against my grain to kill a wild animal, native animal. You know, I was a member of the Sierra Club and a conservationist and nature lover. And so I had a huge inner turmoil about whether to kill the fox or not.
So at some point later in the book, you say, above all, I was concerned for the animals. And these are the animals on the farm after you'd been taking care of them. And this owner was, he was a tough guy to get along with. But you were concerned about the animals. And so should I reveal this what happened then when you aimed the gun at the fox?
Okay, it's a little spoiler, but yes.
Okay.
Go ahead, you can reveal it. There's some other ones that I may not answer your question.
Oh, yeah, because I don't want you to spoil it for readers, but when you say that killing a fox would go against all the conservation values you've grown up with, and I had to weigh which was more important, a fox's life or a lamb's. And your dad was, he loved outdoors. In fact, when I was getting ready to go by myself to Germany, and my dad was apprehensive. But what were your parents like? How did they let you go off to Norway on your own? Lisa, what were your parents like?
Well, I grew up in Mill Valley and with four siblings and graduated from high school there in 1969. So Mill Valley, as most people in Northern California probably know, is right next to San Francisco. Most people probably know that the 60s was quite a time for a revolution. And my parents were actually very liberal. My father was on the board of Northern California ACLU. He marched with siblings against the Vietnam War in the streets of San Francisco and Berkeley. And they really gave us a lot of free rein to lead our lives unless we came home at 4 a.m, in which case that was not okay. But they were glad I was going to Norway because they knew that it was something I really wanted to do. I wanted to become a farm advisor for developing nations, and I needed to start learning how to farm. And I wanted to do it in a foreign country, not on a big mechanized American farm. And they gave me their blessing to go to Norway.
You start your book on September 22nd, 1972, but that's not when you left Mill Valley. And why did it take you? You left Mill Valley in April the 12th of 1972. So well, why did it take you so long to get from Mill Valley to
Well,
Norway?
The September 22nd, that is the flashback. That's the prologue.
Right. Yeah.
But then the next, so we're talking May 18th. So I left Mill Valley in April and arrived in Oystese on May 18th. So it was 6 weeks. And so it took me that long because I took the very cheapest way of traveling. You know, just we didn't have any money. It wasn't from a rich family. And so I took buses across the United States and then Icelandic Airlines. And I visited friends along the way in various places. Took Icelandic Airlines, visited another exchange student, an Icelandic girl in Reykjavik for 2 nights. Visited my family in Denmark for 2 weeks. I'd spent 13 months with them as an exchange student. And then I took a ferry to Oslo in Norway and spent a day and then another train over the mountains and a bus, which finally set me down at, you know, early in the morning on May 18th. So that's why it took me 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I was going on the cheap and I was having fun.
Oh, yeah. An adventure. Lisa Greensfelder and I are going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to continue our conversation about how she spent time on a mountain farm in Norway. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Lisa Greensfelder, a California girl who spent time on an ancient mountain farm in Norway. Now, in the title of your book, Accidental Shepherd, How a California Girl Rescued an Ancient Mountain Farm in Norway. And ancient? How ancient was this farm? I'm going to ask you to read. I'm going to skip over to chapter 19, Lisa, and you're starting to wonder what the meaning of this place where you are, what the meaning of Hove means, for example. So would you read how ancient this place was.
Yes, Nancy. Chapter 19, A Temple for the Gods. I was walking home from the mailboxes one evening. The mailboxes were about a 15-minute walk from the house. When a question popped into my mind, if anyone knew the answer, it would be Torkel. And Torkel is the farmer next door who has become one of my best friends and helps me more than just about anyone else. So I took a side trip to his barn, where I found him cleaning up. What does the word hove mean, I wanted to know. That's easier to answer than most of your questions, Lisa, he said with a smile. They say that a hove is a heathen temple, and by that they mean that it's a building where the old gods were worshipped, Freya, Thor, Odin, and the others. Well, then why is your farm called Hoveland? Torkel rubbed his chin and leaned his shovel against the wall. I suppose that the best answer comes from those smart university people. They say that if a farm is named Hoveland, there was a hove on it at some point in time. His smile broadened to a grin. So you can write home to your mother that you've joined the heathens at Hoveland. I laughed, but I was more astonished than amused. In junior high school, I'd loved reading stories of the old gods. I knew about Thor and his hammer, and one-eyed Odin and evil Loki who murdered beloved Baldur. Those Norse myths were the stories that Vikings told each other in a faraway place a very long time ago. Now, suddenly, they were not far away at all. If I understood Torkel correctly, these gods had been right here on the farm, worshipped in a temple that his ancestors may have built. Where was the hove, I wanted to know. How old was it? What did it look like? What kinds of ceremonies took place in it? Lisa, Lisa, so many questions, he cried, throwing up his hands. I wish I could answer them all, but I can't, and I don't know anyone who can. One thing I do know is that our old kings started forcing us to convert to Christianity about 1,000 years ago. So our hove was probably built before then. Do you have any idea where it could have been? I asked, hopefully. Maybe. I've always thought that someday traces of it might be found near the burial mound. Of course, the archaeologists would have to dig deep to find anything. A lot of soil has built up over the past 1,000 years. Burial mound? I asked. I had no idea what he was talking about. Now he was the one who was surprised. He took me by the elbow and led me outside. Up there, he said, pointing to the hill separating his farm from Johannes's. It's in plain sight from your kitchen window, too. Of course, I had noticed this strange hump, but if I had given it any thought at all, I would have guessed I was looking at a pile of rocks cleared from the field so long ago that soil and grass had now covered it over.
Now, you mentioned some of these friends that helped you out, particularly when you were just getting started, these neighbors. They were very nice, but they're not affectionate, and maybe affectionate's not the word. They were happy to shake your hand, but they didn't exchange hugs. That's not what they were like. And they were very nice and helpful. You mentioned some of your friends. And there you are living by yourself, but you liked it, didn't you? Living by yourself.
I actually loved living by myself. In fact, and I don't get into this in the book, Nancy, but there would be Sundays when maybe three or four different groups of people would come to the farm to keep me company and bring a picnic lunch or, you know, come in and have lunch with me. And there were times when I actually would hide so they couldn't see that I was there and, you know, run upstairs and get under the covers of the bed upstairs so that if they happened to open the door and walk in and look for me, they wouldn't find me. I just needed time alone, because the rest of the time I was working really hard. And when I was with people, it was still a strain for many months to really communicate well and to understand them. But I had a lot of friends, and indeed, I never saw anyone touch anyone else except for shaking hands. And, you know, coming from California where everybody's really, you know, yeah, our emotions are just right out there, hugs.
Or even Southern Europeans. Southern Europeans are much more demonstrative, yeah.
Yes.
But not the Norwegians.
Nope.
But I do want to ask you about a friend, if you want to tell us who Edvard was.
Edvard was this very handsome, 6'2", lovely, quiet, shy guy who appeared a couple weeks after I'd been on the farm, just out of the blue. I was working in the barn, and he introduced himself. I didn't understand who he was. And he said, well, he was here to do some work. And he proceeded to harness up the horse, which I hadn't seen anybody do to that point in time, and take her outside, hitch her to a two-wheeled manure cart, and start shoveling up the piles of manure that Johannes had put out in the field early in the spring, but that he had not spread over the grass. And so Edvard was taking all the manure, which was now suffocating the grass, and driving it back to the edge of the field and put it into a big pile. So he started appearing every week or two or three, and we became very good friends, and I pretty much started to fall in love with him, like, right away.
But he was going to see, he was gone a lot, and in fact, he was attending maritime school then.
Yes.
Now, I mentioned that these people were so nice to you, and they surprised you with something, and we learn as readers that they discovered you had big feet. Lisa, why did they discover you had big feet?
Well, this comes much later in the story, right? This is what you're alluding to. Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
there's so many things happening that we don't have time to cover all the adventures you had. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, in December, out of the blue, I was called up by someone, a scout from Norway's second most popular person. The most popular person in Norway was King Olaf. The second most popular was a man named Erik Bye, who was a singer and a storyteller and an author and the host of various special television shows. And back then, there was one television station in Norway that broadcast for 9, 10, sometimes 11 hours a day, and that was it. So everybody in Norway would watch his special television shows, and he was going to do 6 of them the year I was there. And somebody had written him a letter saying, hey, there's this girl from California. She's 20 years old. She's living alone on this remote mountain farm and doing all this work that most Norwegian kids don't want to do anymore. And all the Norwegian boys are not taking over their farms, but she's from California. She'd be a great person for your show. So he invited me to the show. And it was filmed in Oslo. I got to see the big city, which was really amazing. The neighbor boys took over the tedious morning and evening chores for me at that point. There were a lot of them because all the animals were in the barn. And a big surprise for me was that I was never quite sure who it was, but people had gotten together and had created a Norwegian bunad, the Hardanger bunad, the national costume of Norway, the traditional national, beautifully handmade, embroidered and quilted and with Hardanger seam and sewn costume for me. And that was presented to me on the show.
And they want you to put it on. They want you to put it
they
on.
They want me to put it
come
on.
Come back out.
Yes.
And
come
show
back
us.
Out.
Yeah.
But the problem was, They knew I had big feet. They, you know, heard I had big feet. They'd seen my feet. And so they got 2 sizes of shoes so to make sure that there was a size that fit me. And by golly, there was not, they were not big enough, either of them. I do, full disclosure here, I wear 10.5 wide and I'm only 5'3".
Oh,
wow. Not big feet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I didn't think you were that tall, but. Okay, so they thought, oh gosh, what are we going to do?
There was a headline there, actually, on the newspaper. Lisa, you know, Lisa has big feet.
Oh, or something. You made headlines with your feet.
I made headlines with my feet. So they scoured the whole studios, the main television studio, the only television studio in Oslo, and couldn't find shoes big enough for me. So the question was, should I wear my black clogs, which I'd been wearing, or should I go barefoot? So I came out barefoot at the end of the show.
Well, when you committed to going to Norway, you expected to be there for the summer, but it turns out you were there a total of 2.5 years. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Because you also wanted to go to ag school there. But there's so many things that you learned during those 2.5 years that you learned how to, if a sheep was having trouble, a ewe was having trouble delivering a baby, a lamb, you learned how to reach in there and pull the feet out first. And that was sweet because that turns out, but
I have to correct you a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want the feet to come out first. If the feet are coming out first, you have to push them back in.
Yeah.
You want the nose to come out with the feet.
Yeah, that's why. But you had to reach in after that.
Yes.
Anyway, so we follow along with you learning how to help a mother sheep deliver her baby. But you know what? Those of us who love animals, it was so hard to read about slaughtering lambs. And so I'm not going to ask you to go into detail about that, but that was part of what your responsibility was to these animals that you're taking care of.
Yeah.
So you are living by yourself, and we know that summers are very long, but that's not a problem. You get sunlight, that's nice. But these long winter, you get down. So what did you do to soothe yourself? What soothed you when those long winters got you down, Lisa?
Well, I alluded to it in the prologue there. And really, I would go into the barn and just sit with the sheep. And there were these wonderful animals. If I went in late at night, they'd be lying down, chewing their cuds, little bleats every once in a while. I'd go and I would talk to the horse, Begonia. And it was just so quiet and soothing and calm that was my self-soothing, to go into the barn.
Yeah, these animals.
Yep.
Well, like I say, there are so many adventures in here, and those of us who grew up in cities and towns are learning along with you what it's like to really be a part of nature. And I think that's one inspiration for me, that I want to be closer to nature like you did. Maybe not exactly like you did. Is there any parting words of wisdom that you would like to leave us with, Lisa?
You know, everything is so mechanized these days, and everything's internet, internet, internet. And my parting words are that I think everybody should try to go out and do something, not as a tourist, but try to go someplace else. It could be someplace different in the United States or someplace abroad, and really get to know that place as somebody who's living there, you know, even 2 weeks or a month, but not just go traveling, taking a bus here and there or a train, or, you know, seeing all the tourist places, but sit down in an Italian village and find out what people are doing, and learn the language as much as you can so you can talk to people. And I think everybody needs to do that, to just broaden their experience and understanding of life and the world and the universe.
Well, people might like to know that you did come back to the United States, you got married, and you have a son, and your life now is a very rich experience too. It was so nice to read that you knew practically instantly when you met your husband-to-be, that he was the one.
Yep, that's true.
I think that's a nice romantic note to conclude our conversation with, Lisa. And maybe you'll inspire some young people to consider such adventures as you had when you were a youngster.
I hope so.
My guest has been Lisa Greensfelder. Her book is Accidental Shepherd: How a California Girl Rescued an Ancient Mountain Farm in Norway.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
I wish to now release all past trauma. Trauma that I don't wish to see, but that I experienced, or believe I experienced, it doesn't matter which. I want it all released, all dissolved, even my outcry, been fully released, away forever. Not just in this life, but in all future days, any future life, gone, no more. I don't dispute the trauma. I don't fight with it. I don't reject it. I don't push against it. I simply choose to release it with my loving goodbye. I am, in this moment, loving all the protections it ever provided to me. I love all the reasons I chose to go through it. I forgive all perpetrators now and forever. I release them from their doing just what we had agreed they would do. I'm now releasing myself fully from all victim energy. I stand full tall in letting it all go. I'm sending it all of it, every bit, on its way with my loving goodbye. Releasing that past, less hate.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.